Although psychic ability has been variously mystified, glorified, obfuscated, demonized, and reviled, when all is said and done, it's nothing more than a basic human capacity that can be further developed by just about anyone. It's nothing special, except in the way that we are all special. The sixth sense, intuition, ESP, paranormal intelligence, high sense perception, the third eye, the sixth chakra, what I will refer to as PSI, spelled P-S-I, on this audio tape, is part of our natural human endowment. It's all right there in our genetic hardwiring, ours for the asking. Undoubtedly, some people are born better wired for it, so to speak, than others. But this is no different from the way that some people are born with more athletic ability or musical talent than the norm. One thing is certain. Whatever skill level you are currently starting with, you can expand it considerably. In fact, I've seen students who appear to have very little promise in this regard become extremely adept with a simple application of time, effort, and commitment. If you think about it, you probably can point to times when you've read the minds of others, had a gut feeling that overrode logic, or knew what was going to happen before it actually did. Sometimes you knew who was calling you before you picked up the phone, or you heard from someone you'd only just thought of that day, after a hiatus of months or even years. And perhaps, too, you've known the feeling of being possessed by a kind of inspiration that had you speaking, writing, or expressing yourself in ways you'd never thought to do consciously. Later, you might look at what you wrote, said, or performed and think, "Wow, who did that?" Because these occurrences seem to arrive unbidden and don't fit into our rationalist view of the world, we usually discount them or forget about them. But we're missing a big opportunity, because with or without our conscious agreement, just below the surface of our lives, this boundless abiding intelligence quietly sits and waits for us to recognize it. So let me be clear that this audiobook and the guided imagery exercises in it are designed to help you gain access to your own psychic ability in an integrated, practical fashion to better serve you and the people around you. You will be able to measure the value of the information you get by the effect that it has on the people and the projects around you, and not least of all, on yourself. You'll see that you already have access to all the information you need, and you'll be able to get at it more and more readily with the benefit of consistent practice and experience. And you'll experience some intriguing side benefits. Even if you're a pretty terrific person to start with, engaging in this process might make an even better human being of you, because it will ask you to open your heart in order to gain access to PSI. This is what's been happening in my practice as a psychotherapist all these years. Very simply put, when the heart is open to its own boundless, compassionate, loving energy, boundaries dissolve, and intuitive information starts showing up in a more consistent, predictable way. And the guided imagery process, as I've designed it, is even good for your health. The heart-opening imagery that generates feelings of love, compassion, and gratitude will also speed up healing from cuts, fractures, and burns. It'll lower blood pressure, blood sugar, and blood cholesterol levels. Imagery has long been acknowledged to be an effective reducer of anxiety and depression because it has a direct impact on neurohormone levels in the body. Researchers have also found that imagery produces effects indicating heightened immune functioning. In fact, it was in this context of health that I first realized how potent a technique imagery could be for delivering up psychic information. People who were using my imagery audio tapes for cancer, diabetes, and arthritis were reporting getting unexpected intuitive insights and psychic pops as they were listening to the tapes. They were not looking to have this happen. It just did. These gratuitous visits of insight struck me as particularly compelling evidence that guided imagery was indeed a fertile breeding ground for psi. Unfortunately, we've heard a little bit too much about people becoming psychic from experiences of terror, trauma, near-death experiences, or some sort of out-of-body experience. And yes, it's true that people's psi skills can get activated in these ways. Perhaps because these avenues are dramatic, they've gotten an inordinate amount of attention. But the open-hearted route is a far easier, more pleasant, and more commonplace way to expand psychically. It's how many psychotherapists come to expand psychically over the years, myself included. The third eye does not necessarily have to be bonked open by some horrendous event. The gentle, gradual heart route is reliable, satisfying, and effective. When we're relaxed and can genuinely welcome the emotions of love, empathy, compassion, and gratitude, the closed lid over the slumbering third eye gets a little tap. When we begin to consistently connect with others from this rich and tender, open-hearted place, that eyelid starts to stir, even flutter a little. And when we've so cultivated this open-hearted place and so expanded the energy around the heart that our boundaries have stretched to include others, then that eye starts to really pop open. When from a place of strength and well-being, we can allow our normally limited sense of self to dissolve. We can take in the whole world and every intelligent vibrating particle in it. The whole universe can fit easily into the vast, boundless space of the open heart. And there's room to spare for several worlds more. And from the open heart, we get the true picture of exactly who and what we are. The view is stunning. We become an enormous energy field that has instantaneous reach everywhere. When this happens, the third eye has popped wide open, and we can consciously keep it open for long stretches at a time by remaining in this open-hearted state. Using data from research in the field, from my own intuitive experiences, and from my interviews with 43 highly skilled intuitives, people who shared with me the details of their own development and inner process, I'll look at the ways precognitive, telepathic, and healing abilities develop, and at the different life events and daily practices that activate psi. Many of the people I spoke with are well-known intuitives, authors, teachers, healers, researchers, and consultants. Several have been running their own training programs for years, and many are regularly consulted by physicians, police departments, government agencies, and corporations. In my sample, there are 12 people with PhDs, 9 with MAs, and 4 with MDs. There are psychotherapists, physicians, nurses, corporate trainers, medical intuitives, engineers, school administrators, finance officers, spiritualist ministers, computer programmers, artists, entrepreneurs, energy healers, dancers, and martial arts trainers. From all of my sources, I've tried to tease out what I feel are the common core elements to opening up to psi ability. Key components that show up again and again, both in the research and in each practitioner's experience. I've separated out and described these elements, made several general suggestions, and on tape 2, I've incorporated them into guided imagery exercises. If you're intrigued but feel a little timid or tentative about investigating this terrain, or if you're worried about all this being just a little too weird for you, please take some comfort from my own personal biography. My thinking and methods are the product of almost 30 years of committed, ethically bound professional work as a psychotherapist. I'm a regular, practical sort of person, solid citizen, mother of three, married to the same guy for 30 years, great cook, lousy housekeeper, steeped in the Judeo-Christian ethic, and a registered voter. In short, I'm a pretty common sense sort of person who sports a solid, working left brain, and who has put her psi ability to good use both personally and professionally. When all is said and done, I suppose I have two wishes for you listening to this recording. First, I hope it demystifies the workings of your sixth sense to the extent that this ordinary latent human ability opens up further for you and becomes a simple extension of your everyday perception, a practical tool at your service and in the service of others, without the titillating razzmatazz and melodrama that too often surround it, cheapen, and diminish it. And second, I hope it opens your heart a little wider and brings you into closer contact with the huge mystery, the boundless intelligence, the compassionate, loving wisdom, and the everyday magic that is all around and inside each and every one of us. The general territory I'm looking at is what parapsychology researchers call PSI, P-S-I, the knowing and sensing that overleaps logic, analysis, and rational thought and just shows up. This is called the sixth sense, intuition, ESP, psychic ability, telepathy, clairvoyance, high sense perception, paranormal intelligence, or PSI. For my purposes here, I won't be spending a lot of time on the phenomenon of psychokinesis, which is about making things happen from a distance, as in the tricks of spoon bending, table tipping, and the like. And I pretty much ignore the ghosts and goblins and spirit aspect of things, too. What interests me most is how we get useful information that bypasses normal cognition, perception, or logic. I differentiate among three ways of knowing that often get confused and interchanged. The first is what I call knowledge that comes from experience, the second, intuition, and the third is what I refer to as psychic knowing. Because of the discomfort that the word psychic generates, it's often downplayed or called by the name of its weaker but more respectable cousin, intuition, even when psychic is what people really mean. Several of the people I interviewed, in fact, told me that they deliberately avoided using the term psychic. They preferred calling themselves intuitive counselors or seers or spiritual advisors, anything but psychics. The knowledge that comes from experience can be as fast and smooth as intuition, but it's not the same thing. It's the product of logical thinking that has simply become quick and automatic. It's cause and effect, common sense, accelerated by repetition. An example of this happened recently with a new client of mine, a beautiful, chisel-featured woman of 61, successful writer, with badly metastasized lung cancer. She came to see me for guidance in choosing some holistic therapies after a failed course of chemotherapy. The overriding impression that I got from meeting her was that she seemed very, very tired. While taking her history, I asked her a couple of standard questions about what she had to live for and how much emotional support she was getting. At some point in our conversation, I became aware of feeling a vague sort of discomfort, a very familiar feeling that I'm used to experiencing in my sessions. The best way I can describe it is as a nonspecific sense that something important has been skipped over. Invariably, when this happens, my interest gets very activated, and before I even know why, I become like a heat-seeking missile going back and forth, circling all around and scanning for the buried hotspot. At the same time, and possibly quite unconsciously, my artful friend was doing her best to steer me away from the place, and so we danced our little dance for several minutes. Somehow my questions began circling around her relationship with her husband of 36 years, gently poking and prodding around here and there, and with each of her answers she dodged me elegantly. Finally, I leaned forward, elbows on thighs, and asked, "So, is it fair for me to assume then, Jane, that even though your husband's a good man and he's very worried about you and he wants to do everything he can to help you and keep you alive, you don't really experience him as a source of emotional support?" Her eyes widened, her mouth dropped open, her breath caught, and she very quickly said, "Oh, I would never say that." I leaned forward with my best conspirator's smile and whispered, "I know. That's why I'm saying it." Before she could help herself, she laughed out loud, like a girl. Our eyes made contact, and the connection was made. In that moment, the tension between us dissipated, the ground rules shifted, and we both knew that from then on we'd be telling each other the truth. In this instance, my knowing what to look for and how to guide this woman into speaking the truth about herself appeared to be intuitive, but it wasn't. It had to do with having sat in my therapist's chair for years and having heard answers to the question about emotional support scores of times before. I knew that even a middling marriage under these circumstances would get a footnote here. Intuition, on the other hand, has nothing to do with logic, although it can certainly work in harmony with it. Intuitive knowing brings, through normal sensory channels, information that by all accounts we aren't supposed to be getting, because it's about someone or something other than us. It's as though our personal boundaries were extended over more territory than just our own skins, and so we're picking up data from the environment as if it were about us. It's intuition operating when a hotel elevator door opens to reveal a man who looks perfectly harmless, but nonetheless we find our bodies bristling with alarm, as if we were presented with concrete external danger. The feeling, in fact, might be so compelling that we may actually decline to enter the elevator and instead fake a gesture of having forgotten something and needing to go back to our room. We're experiencing intuition when the phone rings and we get an irrationally happy, optimistic, expanded feeling, as if something good were about to happen as a result of the call. Or when holding an unopened letter, we have a feeling of sadness or dread because our senses have somehow registered that bad news lies inside. Now, this needn't be about life or death matters. Just a short while ago, my stomach sank as I held an envelope, and lo and behold, inside was a notice raising my office rent by $50 a month. Not exactly wonderful news, but not the end of the world either. When my client walks in and my throat tightens up with her unexpressed grief, that's intuition, too. My distinction between intuition and psychic knowing is this. Intuition is a natural extension of normal sensory perception, but going beyond the individual boundaries of our skin and picking up what's happening in the environment or in the hearts, minds, and bodies of someone else. It's a greater sensitivity or empathy than we might normally expect, but it doesn't feel extraordinary in any way. It's our same old senses, just stretched over a larger terrain. On the other hand, what I'm calling psychic information is a sudden cognitive pop, an instantaneous awareness of a whole idea, sometimes a whole set of ideas or a complete conceptual system that bypasses anything we would consider to be the normal process of thinking. These pops, sometimes instantly apprehended, sometimes first spoken aloud, then later understood, will later strike us as odd, although at the time that they are popping, they feel perfectly normal and natural. They are the stuff that has us asking, where on earth did that come from? Now, it's true that we're all wired for psi from birth, but it's also true that some of us are more wired than others. Certainly, psi is an inborn, universal human capability, a natural extension of our built-in perceptual apparatus, albeit one that gets underplayed and overlooked in our culture. With focus and awareness, however, we can all expand our current level of psi functioning to an impressive extent. We know from remote viewing experiments at the Stanford Research Institute and elsewhere that almost anyone with a minimum of training and preparation can perform simple psychic experiments. Researchers Charles Puthoff and Russell Targ began their now famous series of studies by using only established psychics as their subjects, but later they progressed to using so-called ordinary people with results that were nearly as impressive. They found that when people were instructed to report their most fleeting internal impressions and to resist any attempts at interpreting them, they scored extremely well. But some folks are just born with an extraordinary ability to perceive things that most of us don't, at least not readily. Frequently, these are the people who have other traits smacking of unusual quantities of inborn right-brainness, imaginativeness, musical ability, artistic ability, emotional sensitivity, bilateral dominance, that's two-handedness, spontaneity, and strong spiritual leanings from a very young age. Most people will have a first memory of a psi experience at about age 3 or 4. There's usually another major flurry of psi activity at puberty, along with all the other hormonal flurrying. Typically, pregnancy, childbirth, and menopause are also times of accelerated psi expansion in women. A childhood psi experience might consist of being able to sense what people are thinking and feeling, or seeing the actual energetic traces of thoughts, called thought forms, springing from people's heads. Some children see colorful, fuzzy auras around people or things and assume that this is the way the world looks to everyone. Many kids perceive spirits around the house, grandma or Aunt Fanny, or strange visitors in the bedroom after being tucked in at night. Some people say that it was only later, as an adult, that they could understand that the night terrors they experienced as children were probably the result of these spirit visitors. Some children see future events unfolding, either awake or in dreams, and as children frequently will, they confuse seeing these things with making them happen. As a result, with a child's logic, some kids shut down their perceptions in an effort to keep bad things from happening to people. A fortunate few do grow up in a family or community that accepts, values, and understands psychic experiences and has a vocabulary for them, encouraging their development. The Reverend Gregory Keene, a psychic with a solid track record for accuracy and consistency, based in Girard, Ohio, was such a kid, a fourth-generation psychic who was identified and appreciated in his family for having the ability to continue in the tradition of his mother, grandmother, and great-grandmother. He was then mentored by Dana Bailey, another psychic in the community, from the time he was 9 until the time he was in his 30s. But Greg's experience is the exception. It's more likely for very psychic children to shut down because of a negative reaction from a family member. Some of these children are seen as crazy or weird. Some are accused of lying or manipulating to get attention. And still others are discouraged simply by being ignored. Accidents, traumas, abuse, and terror states will frequently open psi abilities as well. Many ascribe this to the out-of-body state that people move into in order to protect themselves from fully experiencing terrible things. Psychologists call this a dissociated state because the person is emotionally removed from what they're experiencing. What often gets overlooked, however, is the highly adrenalized state we move into at these times, the dramatic shift in neurohormone activity. Designed to help us survive life-threatening situations, this adrenalized state opens and extends perception. Sometimes we even feel that things are happening in slow motion during these times. Our perception is so exquisitely attuned, even while we're emotionally detached at the same time. So shifting hormone levels are also a key to psychic perception. Our biochemistry will also shift at times of intense grief or when we fall madly in love. The death of a loved one may prompt a call to a psychic, and other worlds may open up from that. One intuitive in my interview sample told me that when her closest friend was suddenly and violently murdered several years ago, she was beside herself, shaken to the core. She was so distressed that she became obsessed with finding out how and where her friend's spirit was and whether or not it was at peace. The only time she felt any measure of calm was while she was exploring these questions, and so she spent a lot of time learning about the world of the occult. By the time she found the reassurance she was looking for, she had developed a substantial amount of intuitive skill herself. But just the intense, unmitigated experience of grief in and of itself can open people up to psi. When people can allow themselves to experience the full impact of their pain without numbing it or shutting it down, they generate a lot of energy around their hearts, and this can spring them wide open. The other adrenalized state that can give the third eye a substantial jolt is falling in love, again for very different reasons and with an entirely different set of emotions. The energy around the heart is intense, and the human energy field expands. In the rosy view of those who are madly in love, the whole world is beautiful, along with everyone and everything in it. Sensory perception is sharp and clear, and each day feels like a glorious, miraculous gift. In short, we're high as a kite. This adrenalized state of being madly in love usually lasts for about 6 months to a year. And during this time, we experience coincidences, synchronicities, psychic pops, and enhanced intuitive sensitivity. Later, when the initial brew of adrenalized hormones is traded in for the more sedate serotonin mix of a mellower, more vintage sort of love, a different set of perceptions and experiences take over, more stable, less dramatic. A full-blown near-death experience will also accelerate psychic ability. From the bulk of the information gleaned from my interviews, I think it's safe to assume that full-blown near-death experiences do, in fact, increase ESP ability from whatever baseline ability people start with. The most likely explanation for this is that near-death experiences seem to stimulate the temporal lobes, the part of the brain that's thought to be involved with producing psi effects. Studies show that when the hippocampus and the amygdala, two structures within the limbic system, are electrically stimulated, intense hallucinatory activity can be generated. Subjects stimulated in this way report experiencing apparitions, floating, spinning sensations, out-of-body experiences, inner voices, a sense of a presence nearby, and powerful convictions of deep meaningfulness. These responses are typically reported both in people's descriptions of near-death experiences and in their recountings of psychic experiences. These responses also show up frequently in reports of UFO sightings and alien encounters, which I confess I bring up here reluctantly and with some chagrin. However, data is data. And like it or not, over half of my 40-plus, very grounded, sensible, no-nonsense interviewees described experiences of either UFO sightings or full-blown extraterrestrial contact. But whether you can accept these experiences as real or not, there is no question that there is a striking similarity between classic near-death experience descriptions and UFO reports. The point to keep in mind here, whether or not you believe in the reality of these encounters, is that temporal lobe activity is connected with psi experience. This is further substantiated by the high incidence of temporal lobe epilepsy, convulsions, seizures, and other brain anomalies in that part of the brain in people with high psi scores. Another way to open psychically is by spending time in close proximity to someone with a powerful psychic field. Studying with certain teachers and healers will do this. It's a kind of direct induction. A weaker, smaller, or less coherent field will naturally want to match the frequency of a stronger one. So teachers, healers, and psychics with powerful energy fields can naturally entrain ours to match theirs, even if they're not trying to. They can amp us up to more closely match their own energy and psi ability, which is all the more reason to choose our teachers wisely. So not only is intuitive opening a matter of inborn ability, of shifting hormones, and temporal lobe activity, it's an energetic phenomenon as well. We can now move into territory that's a little more in line with everyday reality, ways of opening to psi that we all can relate to, and that offer us some practical direction. The most obvious category is the regular practice of certain right brain activities, such as meditation, yoga, qigong and various martial arts, self-hypnosis, breathwork, focused performing in the arts or athletics, biofeedback, prayer, and guided imagery. All these activities accelerate the development of intuition. Perhaps these practices help because of the sheer discipline their pursuit requires, because of the way they impose a rigorous attentional focus on their practitioners, and thus enhance concentration. Maybe they activate Psi because of the way they heighten the amount of energy, or qi, in and around the body. Possibly they help because they clear the mind, leaving practitioners a purer channel for accurate, uncontaminated information. Or maybe a meditative activity like prayer alters neurohormone levels and strengthens our intentional connection to the divine source of all information. I think receptivity to Psi experience increases for all those reasons. But the simplest and most basic one is that the right side of the brain is home base to the altered state. This is the territory where sensory perception, emotional acuity, imagination, dreaming, holistic thinking, creativity, humor, and mystical experience all comfortably and synergistically coexist. And so, right brain practices such as meditation, imagery, will catalyze a quick, deep entry into the altered state. We know from the research that they actually alter the blood chemistry, producing the body's natural equivalent of tranquilizers and antidepressants. These gentler neurohormone shifts will also open and extend perception at the same time that they can alter brainwave activity. Scientists Elmer and Elise Green, for instance, early pioneers in biofeedback and altered state research at the Menninger Foundation, found that their biofeedback equipment could train subjects to shift their brainwaves from normal waking beta patterns into the slower alpha and theta rhythms. Once in those states, nearly half their subjects reported a very high number of spontaneous ESP experiences, particularly during theta. Theta is the state our brains slip into just before falling asleep and while waking up, although some people are entirely capable of walking around and performing everyday tasks extremely well in this zone. But meditation needn't be defined as an isolated activity done in a lab or on a special prayer cushion. It's basically nothing more than the exercise of singular, mindful attention in a relaxed but focused and alert way. Scrubbing pots, drinking tea, playing golf, sketching, even shining shoes when done in a highly focused, mindful way is meditation. Focused attention alters brainwave patterns and releases serotonin into the bloodstream, leading to a quieting down of ego activity. Those executive functions of the brain that include environmental scanning, decision-making, assessing, worrying, analyzing. Once ego activity quiets, the subtler inner cues of Psi can become more prominent. It is in this quiet, subtle world of internal images and sensations that many people first hear intuitive wisdom. Of my 43 intuitives, an extraordinary number, 92.7%, were serious meditators, with several having practiced for decades. Many had also grown up spending long periods of time alone, with only their very rich imaginations for company, or out by themselves in nature, communing with birds, trees, animals, and spirits. In fact, an astonishing number, 39%, were raised as only children. Several had also spent a lot of time engaged in serious discipline training in the plastic or performing arts, music, painting, sculpture, dance, and theater, as well as playing competitive sports like gymnastics, skating, swimming, golf, and baseball. Not surprisingly, all of these practices require intense concentration and thus are forms of meditation that engage and exercise the right side of the brain and propel the mind into an altered state. Listening to guided imagery will have this effect too. Over the years, I've received many reports of people experiencing unexpected psychic pops while listening to one of my guided imagery tapes. Being immersed in a guided imagery experience in a state of deep relaxation can result in the kind of altered meditative state that produces crystal clear visions, sudden insights, and a mystical sense of oneness with the universe. Though these were not the intended consequences, they happened just the same. Different forms of meditative right brain practices are thus a safe and steady way of producing the altered state of consciousness, the changes in brainwave activity and biochemistry that produce side effects. Happily, we don't need to go to the trouble of having adrenalized experiences of trauma, abuse, near death, or for that matter, encounters with aliens. Hormones still play a part, but with the meditative practices, adrenaline doesn't run the show. Instead, serotonin and the mellower neurohormones shift consciousness and accompany the changes in brainwave activity. And finally, some people develop their psi capacity simply by cultivating the practice of keeping their hearts open. I would define keeping a heart open as a way of staying consciously full of feeling and engaged, even in the face of suffering and pain, ours and that of those we attend. Although it may initially seem kinder to protect ourselves by closing our hearts down and cutting ourselves off from feeling, it doesn't really work that way, at least not in the long run. The exhaustion of burnout actually comes from being shut down and disconnected from the vast energy supply that our feelings generate. Even the more uncomfortable feelings, such as pain, grief, envy, shame, and fury, are a vast energy source, a furnace full of powerful psychic fuel. We would no more want to disconnect from our feelings than we would want to be unplugged from our vital life force. And of course, it's the emotions that trigger the neurohormone mix that helps to activate psi. Mostly, heartful practice is about keeping the heart open to the world around us, to people, places, ourselves, and the divine. It means coming from a place of empathic attunement. It's about seeing the connections, the interlocking webs of energy among people and things, and residing as much as possible in that place of no separation. So just to summarize these broad life circumstances that activate our psychic ability, they are our inborn ability, trauma, abuse or terror states, near-death experiences, falling in love, grief or heartbreak, proximity to someone with a powerful psychic field, yoga, meditation, guided imagery, and other right brain practices, and living with an open heart. Now I want to tease out and examine the key components of the actual in-the-moment experience of expanding our consciousness and opening up intuitively. I want to carefully describe a process that actually happens in a matter of seconds or less. In order to help you understand these elements, however, I'm going to list them as if they were separate and sequential, but they aren't really. They're all enfolded within one another, part and parcel of the same thing. So please remember that once access to psi is firmly in place, these elements will all come into play simultaneously, and the idea of sequencing becomes irrelevant. Once practice has made this a natural, integrated experience of daily living, you'll need to do very little to consciously gain access to psi, because it will have become automatic. Although it's not absolutely necessary, a certain consistency of location and posture is helpful when first learning a reliable, disciplined way to gain access to psi. Sitting in the same way, in the same place, helps condition the mind and body to activate the intuitive process quickly. For me, these physical habits fell into place as I worked therapeutically with my clients. In my office, I always sat a certain way, in the same chair, facing the same direction, and with the same habit of focusing intensely on the person in front of me. And to this day, even though I no longer need to be sitting in that spot for psi to kick in, it's still the only place where I know for sure that I will always receive multiple hits of information in a continuous flow. Another one of the most reliable, not to mention pleasant, ways of activating psi is by deliberately evoking a state of relaxation. Muscle and body tension, as well as conscious worrying and striving, can be reduced or eliminated through deep breathing, relaxed postural cues, meditation, progressive relaxation, or by shifting the focus of attention to pleasant sensory memories and fantasies. Most of the intuitives I interviewed use some method to initiate relaxation, at least in the beginning stages of their development. Some use two or three deep breaths, others perhaps an affirmation or special prayer. Some work with a sense of settling into their bodies or into their chairs. And some used a symbolic image of a door, a curtain, an eye, a pyramid of energy, or the felt presence of a special helper or guide to initiate their relaxation. Beyond physically relaxing, we need to clear our minds of all the busyness, the mental noise, all the analyzing, worrying, judging, remembering, looking ahead, looking back, comparing, associating, and scanning the environment that we normally do. It's only when the mind is quieted down that the weaker signal of our intuitive voice can be heard. In my sample of intuitives, 41 out of 43 people, an extremely high percentage, practiced meditation on a regular daily basis. And many of them chose to do some ritual or affirmation or mental imagery to clear and quiet their minds, if only for a few seconds, just before tuning into their intuitive data. Another element that seems to be key is the deliberate carving out of sacred space, the establishment of a separate, uncontaminated state of mind, or even an actual physical area for tuning into Sai. By setting a place apart and defining it as spiritual, we're able to enjoin our psychic ability to come from the highest part of ourselves, from the very best within us. Many people use ritual, prayer, symbolic imagery, or some kind of spiritually based concept to invoke a special kind of purity or holiness in their work. As a therapist, I've come to believe that my primary job is to keep the therapeutic container, the sacred space of the relationship, safe and clean, and filled with my highest intentions, so that my clients are free to tell the truth about themselves, and in so doing, to heal and grow. Another powerful component in the operation of Sai is belief. Some of the earliest parapsychology experiments show that people who believe in the reality of ESP actually do better on ESP tests than those who don't believe in it, who actually do worse. So it's best to approach Sai with a modicum of belief, or at least some openness to the possibilities. Being around others who believe in Sai is one way to enhance your own belief. Paying attention and tracking your hits is another. One of my favorite quotes regarding belief comes from the extremely quotable Mona Lisa Schultz, a physician with a PhD in neuroanatomy, who seems to favor hockey and pool metaphors. In describing what she feels is required to gain access to Sai, she says, "Sometimes you just have to suspend disbelief. You can't win if you don't shoot the puck." This combination of intention and belief does the trick, and if it doesn't, you just keep on trying. Nowadays, I count on Sai-based assistance in my work and even take it for granted, which I suppose is the ultimate form that firmly installed belief takes. Generally, it's a good idea to express intention, either aloud or in your mind, in a broad, open-ended way, avoiding aims that are too specific. Many people like to ask simply to be of service, to know what's best, whatever that might be. By not presuming to know what that good is, they avoid falling into preconceived notions or attachments to certain outcomes, obviously easier to do with strangers than with loved ones or oneself. This leads to a willingness to go along with whatever information comes up, even if it makes no initial sense. This approach is more likely to ensure accuracy. Finally, The energy of the open heart, with all its attendant empathy, warmth, and feelings of universal connectedness, is a powerful breeding ground for Psi. The noted researcher Richard Broughton, director of the Institute for Parapsychology in Durham, North Carolina, reports that it's no secret among Psi researchers that the best ESP results come from labs and researchers who can provide a warm, supportive, and caring atmosphere for their subjects. He also notes that the nurturing, feeling tone of the psychotherapist's office will often become a rich source of striking anecdotal evidence of ESP. And in fact, most of the intuitives I spoke with described themselves as emotional, sensitive, empathic, and attuned to feelings. Most said that they were born this way. Several reported they had become even more so by consciously working to open their hearts and become more compassionate towards others, either through psychic or spiritual insights, through their personal work in psychotherapy, through experiences of their lives, or through a sense of responsibility to use their skills well. Sometimes a loss, failure, illness, or trauma broke their hearts open, so to speak, to greater feeling and compassion. Because the heart is the most powerful oscillator in the human body, when it locks into the rhythms of this loving state, the rest of the body, including the brain, lines up with it in a state of internal coherence. These matching frequencies, vibrating throughout the body, produce a deeply meditative aware state, which generates intuitive insights and deep feelings of peace. In my own work, it was certainly true that over the years I became more and more open-hearted and compassionate, and less judgmental. As my competence grew, and as I needed less and less energy to think about what to say, what to do next, I relaxed, and my criticalness of myself and of others, too, began to melt away. In this expanded state, I could allow myself the luxury of sitting back and enjoying the quality of the connection between me and my clients, the sheer richness of it, as they sat across from me in my office. Bathed in a kind of warm pleasure, I could experience a feeling of gratitude for just being there, and I could really look at them, listen to them, take them in with all of my senses, and fully appreciate them. As I heard their stories, I would become suffused with what I can only describe as love for them. Very soft, full, and sweet. Just as Joanna Carroll describes, there was a warmth and expansion around my heart. I was moved and touched by their journeys, by the doggedness and courage that kept them going, in spite of very harsh life circumstances. I could see and feel what was difficult for them, as if I were experiencing their troubles, even though the particular circumstances might not be difficult for me at all. And I was frequently and easily moved to empathic tears, which after I got used to their regular appearance, didn't bother me a bit. And even though their distortions and flaws were perfectly apparent to me, believe me, this was not a blind, flight into life state of Pollyanna denial. Nonetheless, from my therapist's chair, I could see my clients in a much larger dimension. It was as though I were seeing them from a detached place, from above the fray, away from tightly held judgments and storylines. From this larger view, I could appreciate their beauty and the paradoxes and ironies of our shared, confounding human condition. In this nourishing state of mind, I could be protected from colluding with my client's limited view of themselves. In the bright, soft light of the open heart, their hidden splendor was apparent, and I could see who they really were. My professional training also helped me to open my heart. I had a graduate school supervisor, Barry Levine, who early on taught me something profound that has always stayed with me. He told me that if I had no empathy for my client, it was because I hadn't collected enough data. So if I found myself devoid of compassion, my job was to get the missing information. However, this business of opening the heart is not just about loving another person and feeling empathy for him or her. That's a piece of it, but that's just a piece. My energy healer friends would say that this kind of personal one-on-one loving is mostly at the second chakra level, the energy center in the belly. That's the seat of our earthbound emotions, our creativity, our sexuality, and our feelings of romantic love. But what we're really talking about here is fourth chakra business. This is the energy vortex located at the heart center in the upper chest, seen metaphysically as the seat of wisdom and compassion, and the place in the body where the earth energies of the three lower centers meet the spiritual energies of the three upper ones. The heart center is the seat of a vaster, deeper kind of compassion and love wisdom. It's about lovingness rather than love. It's here that we can begin to glimpse the true nature of the soul and where we can feel our connection to everyone and everything. And it's here, at the heart center level, that we can begin to grasp experientially the complex ideas from theoretical physics that describe how, when all is said and done, we are nothing but vibration in a sea of living, intelligent energy. That although we are disguised as separate solid matter, this appearance of solidity is only how we appear in the overt, concrete order of manifest reality. At a deeper, truer level, we are all nothing but interconnecting, interpenetrating energy fields, transcending time and space, each vibration containing everything in the universe, each subatomic bit of us a hologram for all that is. This is why we can experience instantaneous, direct knowing. This is where those psychic pops come from. All told, then, several key components provide a fertile breeding ground for psi. Consistent place and posture, relaxation, a clear mind, sacred space, belief, intention, and an open heart. Now I'd like to examine the elements that make up the mind state during the actual psychic pop itself. As best I can, I want to break down the internal experience right from the moment that the psychic information is coming through. I'll be replicating these elements in the imagery that I offer you on tape 2. But first, let's take a look at what these components are. Again, keep in mind that they don't happen in sequence. They tend to happen all of a piece. But it's easier to describe them and learn about them by separating them out in this way. Shifting from active to receptive mode is a key ingredient in gaining access to intuitive information. Opening to receiving psi involves surrender into a very alert, aware passivity. The ability to move at will, quickly and easily, into this open, receptive mode is the core of the intuitive experience, and for that matter, of all creative experience. Menninger biofeedback pioneers Elmer and Elise Green coined the phrase passive volition to describe this state of mind, which they defined as a detached and effortless way of envisioning something through deep focus but without striving. Imagining a desired end state creates a fertile field for that to happen. The Greens found in their experiments that imagery alone was often sufficient to manifest a real outcome. Subjects were trained to lower their blood pressure and control many other supposedly autonomic nervous system functions simply by imagining these outcomes. This, of course, is the basis for guided imagery's effectiveness. Kenneth Batchelder's studies established that people impeded their psi functioning with what he called ownership inhibition. A sense that they were personally responsible for making things happen. When they believed this, they became anxious about personal success or failure, and their psi functioning dropped markedly. But when they were encouraged to believe that the outcomes they desired were not in their control, but somehow up to some other agent or circumstance, in other words, when they had a mindset of passive volition, their scores improved. This is why so many psi exercises encourage people to focus on something outside of themselves. A crystal ball, a deck of cards, an imaginary wisdom figure, or even a paperclip, to give them the answers. Every person I interviewed was acutely aware of the need for this attitude of surrender into receptive mode, and was proficient at quickly affecting the detached state of mind that brought the information through. Some, like Iris Salzman and Brian Christopher, were able to stay in this open receptive state of mind almost all the time, with a continual influx of information. They experienced absolutely no lag time between the desire to know something and the appearance of the information. Brian, like Iris and a few others, had become so at home in the mind state of passive volition that unless he deliberately put himself in neutral, his psychic sense was fully engaged and he received images nonstop on streets, in hotel lobbies, at airports, meetings, and even during telephone calls. This constant flow of information, as you might imagine, is not always a day at the beach. Brian, Iris, and some of the other people born with strong wiring for psi had to learn the reverse skill, stopping the information at will for their own peace of mind. Others, like Mona Lisa Schultz, use imagery in conjunction with passive volition. In her practice as a medical intuitive, Mona Lisa provides descriptive information over the phone. Her track record is impressive and accurate. She works by imagining that she's seeing the person in front of her. So, for instance, she'll imagine she's listening to a person's heart, and in a matter of seconds, she'll hear a heartbeat. She then imagines herself watching someone get on a scale, and after a brief pause, she'll see the height and weight register. In her mind's eye, she looks at a slide of some tissue under a microscope, and soon she's seeing some cellular pathology. In spite of the fact that with an MD and a PhD degree in neuroanatomy, she has the training and background to diagnose accurately what she's seeing, she prefers not to make medical diagnoses in her capacity as an intuitive. Instead, she reports to her callers exactly what she sees descriptively, and then encourages them to get checked by a physician in a real, old-fashioned office visit. Another crucial feature of the experience of psi is its quality of deep inwardness. External perception is temporarily cut off. We're inside, not outside, when the information comes to us. For this reason, it's best for most psi trainees to become adept at disengaging their senses from the outside world, at least in the beginning, when they're just starting to get proficient. Later, with practice, people are able to be both places, inside and out, at the same time. So for many, tuning into psi has a quality of moving more and more deeply inward and downward, as if the eyes and ears were turned outside in, facing the deep dark spaces of our inner world. Sometimes people will use an imaginary device to help them shift into that interior space, imagining something like a door or curtains or some other entryway that opens the gate into this other territory. A perfect and very commonplace example of this is the dream state that we all enter during sleep. Not surprisingly, psi is very much at home in the world of dreams and shows up a lot there. This was well established in the ESP dream studies of Montague Ullman and Stanley Krippner, often referred to as the Maimonides Dream Lab studies, where they showed that while dreaming in the lab, subjects were able to achieve an accuracy rate of 83.5%, where chance would be 50%, for correctly perceiving the picture slides that a person next door was concentrating on. Dream studies tend to yield consistently excellent psi results. In my own experience as a therapist, it took quite a while to realize that during those moments when I was delivering psi-derived insights to my clients, I was not actually seeing the people I was talking to. My eyes were pointing in their direction, but I wasn't seeing them. I was tuned elsewhere. So I was always a bit startled and pleased to suddenly see the reaction on the other person's face and to find out that my words had hit home. This looking but not seeing was entirely involuntary. As I examine it now, it's clear to me that this was the natural byproduct of moving my awareness away into some deeper, quieter, more internal place. it was only from this vast interior place that I could receive the information that was needed in that moment and allow it to come through. Along with a receptive mind state and an inward focus, the experience of receiving psychic information also has two related critical features. First, a quality of very alert attention to the subtlest and most fleeting of inner impressions. And second, an acceptance of those impressions as is, without assessing, interpreting, embellishing, or noodling with them in any way. Both are simple skills that can be easily developed. With practice, it's easy to gain tremendous acuity in picking up very delicate, fleeting impressions. Simply by noticing them rather than dismissing them, we can enhance their prominence. And we can also train ourselves to leave the impressions alone in an ambiguous, undefined, and unanalyzed state until their meaning develops in their own way. In fact, even putting these delicate impressions into words runs the risk of distorting them. Some people prefer to draw their impressions if they can. Proof of the validity and effectiveness of staying with simple, unelaborated impressions was established by Charles Puthoff and Russell Targ when they found that anyone could gain access to psi if properly coached. In their remote viewing experiments, subjects were asked to sit in a room and to both draw and describe in words the randomly chosen locations that were at the same time being visited by someone else on the team. The subjects were told to observe and report their most fleeting impressions and images and to withhold any attempts at analysis, interpretation, or elaboration on them. The results were impressive. Their accuracy was so far beyond chance that ample evidence of psi in the average citizen was well established. Puthoff and Targ broke new ground when they spelled out how to observe psi properly. First, they underlined the importance of paying attention to these easily ignored subtle fragments of impressions. In addition, they found that scores improved when subjects gave more weight to certain impressions. To their first impressions, to their more spontaneous and surprising impressions, to impressions that were multi-sensory as opposed to just visual, and to impressions that carried an emotional component. When subjects were coached to pay attention to these things, ordinary citizens became highly proficient, and in a very short period of time, usually a couple of hours. Perhaps the most important contribution these studies made, however, was in pinpointing the confounding influence of secondary elaboration. This is the natural tendency of the mind to make assumptions, interpretations, and elaborations over and above the raw data. It's a common cause for error and distortion. For instance, in a remote viewing experiment, a subject might accurately pick up the impression of, say, the Louisiana Superdome Stadium, which is a huge circular silvery building with metal sides and a white dome that gleams in the sun. But because of secondary elaboration, dismiss it as improbable or else report it inaccurately as a spaceship in the middle of a city. The very act of labeling, which after all is a combination of verbalizing, analyzing, and categorizing, will distort the data. The most difficult component to put into words is the subtle expansion and movement of electromagnetic energy that occurs in and around the body just before and during these appearances of psi. Although subtle and hard to describe, this shift in energy is probably what lies at the bottom of the appearance of psi. The kind of energy I'm talking about here has been called many things: chi, prana, biophysical energy, electromagnetic energy, orgone, vital life force, and much more. At the subatomic level, it's the stuff we're all made of and what we all come from. It flows through and around the body in loops and lines, entering and exiting via hundreds of large and small energy vortices, usually referred to as chakras. When we see the aura, what we're looking at is the denser part of this energy field, the part that's immediately around the body. It's thicker and therefore more visible. Our fields actually extend way beyond us. In fact, they extend infinitely, and they permeate the body as well. In a healthy body, the energy field is ample, coherent, dynamic, and complex, playing host to many variable frequencies. Less healthy fields are punier, more rigid, and more constricted, and hold fewer frequencies. When we've just had a jog, when we feel happy or loving, or when we've just meditated or gotten a massage or listened to a gorgeous piece of music, our fields get bigger and fluffier, as they also do when we've been hanging out in a very energized crowd at a church, a concert, a stadium, or have just spent time by the ocean or running water. In fact, illness and health probably show up in the field first and then work their way down into the denser, more rigidly organized aspects of the body's actual tissue. A very high percentage of the people in my study seem to carry around an inordinate supply of baseline energy to start with. In fact, at certain times in their lives, several of them experience trouble with their electrical appliances. For me, this energetic shift is a palpable thing. As the psychic information is coming through, I feel an expansion, a sense of extension beyond my skin, and a tingling, buzzy heightening of my awareness. Along with a greater acuteness in my perception, I feel softer, mellower, and much more at peace. Although I feel great empathy during these times, more than usual, in fact, the feelings seem to pass right through me, rather than soak into my cells and stay there the way they used to. I used to go home heavy and sort of waterlogged with other people's pain, and that happens less frequently nowadays. It is this energetic aspect, I believe, that accounts for the fact that although I do much less proactive work in this psi-receptive state, more work actually gets done. Paradoxically, my clients reach their goals quickly, even though very little effort has been expended on my part, with far less of the dragging, pushing, prodding, persuading, and confronting that I used to do earlier in my work. I think this is because when I'm working in this way, it's not just me doing the work. I'm part of a whole field, and assistance is everywhere. Subtle tools can exert great force when working in this way, at this energetic level. In the suggestions that follow, I've incorporated practices that ensure a more gradual and balanced kind of opening, so that the systems that modulate the requisite shifts in energy, the endocrine system and the temporal lobes of the brain, for instance, don't get out of balance as a result. There's no need to tax yourself, either cognitively, psychologically, or physically, while you're developing these capacities. Here are 23 specific things you can do to activate, cultivate, and maintain your psychic ability. 1. Focus intent and pay attention. Simple as it sounds, focusing your conscious intention to develop this skill is a powerful way to activate it. Stating your wish, aloud or in your own mind, and then just paying attention to the intuitive process within and around you will expand your psi functioning. Being clear about your desire to do this will automatically organize your thinking and attention and direct energy toward activating psi. 2. Keep a journal. Just as recording dreams helps capture more and more of them for recall, keeping a log of intuitive experiences and recording daily hits and misses enhances psi. It's a concrete way of focusing your attention and of making what is unconscious conscious. 3. Keep like company. One of the most powerful Psi developers seems to be simply spending time, structured or unstructured, with similarly interested friends and colleagues. Because so much of our culture is geared away from giving the right side of the brain its due, it's important, and for many of us even necessary, to get validation from a group of people whose view of reality matches our own. As a result, many people seem to gravitate toward others who are on a similar path of Psi exploration. 4. Find good teachers. Many of the people I interviewed learned from mentors, spiritual teachers, and guides. Some had a hard time finding an appropriate teacher, but when they finally did, it felt to them like they were coming home at last. You can find the right teacher by keeping your ears open, attending conferences and workshops, listening to presenters, talking to friends, and reading people's books. Above all, trust your own instincts about who would be appropriate for you at this time in your life. 5. Seek out solitude. A certain amount of time deliberately spent in reflective solitude is essential for Psi development for many reasons. First of all, solitude will afford you the stillness and quiet that you need in order to hear your own delicate inner voice. It's hard to direct your attention inward if you're surrounded by external stimulation and you're sensitive to it to boot. Second, you need time to reflect upon your thoughts and feelings, your own sense of yourself, your motivations and distortions. This keeps you clear and helps keep the information that you're getting free from your own projections. 6. Spend time in nature. One of the best places to seek out solitude is in the natural world, where you can receive inspiration, balance, and grounding at the same time. Most of the people I interviewed had an absolute rock-bottom need either to frequently visit or else live next to water, woods, or mountains. Not surprisingly, many people felt that as children they had initially developed their Psi abilities by spending a lot of time alone in nature. 7. Be present and aware. Your skills at tuning into Psi will grow just from greater moment-to-moment awareness of whatever it is you're doing. Bringing a single-pointed focus and a quality of being fully present to whatever it is you're doing, whether it's tying your shoes, chopping vegetables, listening to a friend, getting irritated in traffic, or just breathing the air, will help you open your third eye further. After all, psychic ability is really nothing but a kind of extended awareness, a certain heightened quality of presence and concentration. 8. Practice structured meditation. For many people, structured meditation is the key to their psychic development. In my study, meditation was the factor most frequently cited for increasing Psi skill. This is because meditation simultaneously clears and stills the mind, focuses awareness, and in the case of mindfulness and other popular forms of meditation, turns the attention inward. At the same time, it increases discipline, courage, energy, and presence in the meditator. 9. Get physical exercise. It's important as you proceed in your development to keep up your physical strength, to exercise, to build muscle mass, and to take good care of your physical body. Care for the body is needed to balance the growth in psyche and spirit. Not surprisingly, the natural athletes and the very physical people in my survey had the fewest complaints about their bodies, emotions, or hormones going out of balance. 10. Demonstrate awareness and discrimination in eating and drinking. Occasional fasting or a general policy of not overeating was a device mentioned by several people as one way they supported their Psi development. And conversely, deliberately eating heavier foods, such as meat, was used as a device to get grounded back into Earth time. Conscious awareness about eating, not obsessive, just attentive, is self-corrective and will balance out nutritional needs and metabolism naturally. Quite a few people found sugars and alcohol extremely toxic, with their sensitivity to these substances increasing as their solubility developed. Others completely lost their taste for meat and heavier foods.